Thank you. Be seated. Board is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Universal Services versus Sway.
May it please the court, Ms. Lynn Liberato will present argument for the petitioner.
I guess it's versus isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
The next.
May it please the court, also representing Universal Services is Allie and Levy. The issue in this case is what guidance is a jury going to be given in determining whether to assess punitive damages in a workers' compensation case? Because there are no questions of simple negligence or of actual damages, questions on actual damages, workers' comp cases are different from any other type of case in Texas jurisprudence. And therein lies the problem. Because actual damages, because gross negligence is analyzed, defined really in terms of simple negligence. Simple negligence gives an anchor to the determination of whether there should be an assessment of punitive damages. In this case, we are asking this court to provide safeguards to ensure that a jury assesses punitive damages when there is gross negligence, not just based on simple negligence. And the procedural mechanism that we ask this court to put into place is a jury instruction on what simple negligence is. That is what the trial court in this case failed to do. It's also very important from the outset to stress what we are not asking for. We are not asking that there be a question on simple negligence. This court has said that that question is not appropriate in Wright versus Gifford Hill. It is not our position, it has never been our position, from the trial level all the way to this court, that there should be a question. Our position is there should be an instruction, something to give the jury a guidepost to ensure that it is not assessing punitive damages based merely on simple negligence.
The definition of gross negligence, while perhaps not perfect, as good as the legislature could think of, sufficient to inform a reasonable juror that we're talking about something far beyond the failure to exercise reasonable care?
Well, I think that it is, Chief Justice Phillips, in a normal case, because in a normal case, you're not just going to have the definition of gross negligence in and of itself and by itself. The jury in a normal situation is already going to have answered a question and found that there was indeed simple negligence. And so that is a critical distinction. That's what makes workers' comp cases unique, because there's not that guidepost. So in effect, the jury is deciding the issue in a vacuum. So our dispute is not with the definition of gross negligence. Our dispute is with the fact that in this case, in a workers' comp case, there was also there was not a definition.
Let me try my question again, because I didn't get there. Didn't the definition of gross negligence give you plenty of opportunity to argue that simple negligence would not be sufficient, and to show from that definition how gross the conduct had to be, such that even if it might have been helpful to the jury to get a simple negligence instruction for contrast purposes, it does not amount to reversible error?
Well, the dissent in the Court of Appeals addressed that exact issue. And what the dissent said, which we would agree with, in this particular definition that was given, the definition was that allowed the jury to infer. Instead of using the statutory definition, which has that there's an entire one of care, such as to establish, in this case, the definition, which came from the pattern jury charge, said that it was the entire one of care as to indicate a conscious indifference on the part of the defendant. And because of that...
But, of course, you didn't object to that.
But we wouldn't have We didn't, that is correct. We did not object to that, but we didn't feel like we needed to if we had our instruction on negligence. With our instruction on negligence, that would have, I hate to use the word cure because I don't think that it was an error. It's just that I don't think we had to have had it that way. I think it would have helped, certainly, but another way of accomplishing the same purpose is to have that definition of simple negligence there as a point of contrast so that...
We're trying to liberalize on objections to jury charges, but surely you can't complain that one definition is error because an instruction on something else wasn't given, and you requested that instruction, so you don't have to object to it.
Well, I don't think it was error.
The definition that was given.
I don't think that it was error, but if I understood your concern, it was this definition that was given, was it sufficient to apprise the jury of the distinction, or at least sufficient to show that there had to be a higher level of conduct or an extreme level of conduct? And it was not. Not that we couldn't have, and that would have been another approach to object to that particular definition. We just believe that another way to have cured it and that we properly preserved that was to submit the definition of simple negligence. And that, indeed, we did submit to the court, and that was, and obtained a ruling, and that, of course, was denied.
Is it your argument that instruction on ordinary negligence is required to put the gross negligence question in context?
That's exactly right.
If that is your argument, then aren't there a lot of other instructions which the court has tended to disapprove? Mm-hmm. For example, in a products liability case, the ACORD case, saying a manufacturer is not an insurer of the product, which is a correct statement of law, but which the court has tended to say or tend to nudge the jury one way or another, or marshal the evidence on one side or the other that we've disapproved. How is this different?
Well, to be sure, it's always a concern that you don't have too many instructions or that the instructions are going to be impermissible. It's just we have a unique situation here where you have a workers' comp case where there is no other indication to the jury that it can find anything but no negligence at all. When the jury is looking at this situation, it is hearing the allegations and the evidence before it, and it is essentially faced with a decision of finding under the charge either no negligence or gross negligence. And that in this case, it is critical to have that particular instruction in there of simple negligence so that the jury realizes that there is an intermediate ground.
I thought the chart said either there was gross negligence or there was not gross negligence.
That's right. Well,
you're saying that you couldn't make, people that argued this case could not make that distinction clear. The jury thought.
Well, for one reason, it couldn't make it clear because the judge sustained any objections in the closing argument or sustained an objection to the closing argument that talked about the negligence of the other party. And so this was just a part, it is a separate point of error for us on the charge, but taken in context, this permeated the whole trial, and that is the trial court's view that the negligence of the other parties had no relevance, in fact, no appropriateness as far as evidence to present to the jury in making its determination.
Speaking just for a moment of your separate point of error, was your bill of exceptions made before or after the defendant rested?
It was made after the defendant rested, but if I may make two points about that, and I understand where the court's coming from on that. First of all, it's not as such a separate point of error. Our primary point is that there needed to be an instruction on simple negligence. But subsumed in, I believe, our second point of error is this approach by the trial judge, the rulings by the trial judge, that the negligence of the other party wasn't appropriate to present to the jury. And in so far as the Bill of Exceptions, I think that it is being used for something different from what you normally have a Bill of Exceptions for. I think it's clear that from the objection and from the way that from what's before the court that the court excluded it because all of the testimony was to have been the expert's opinion on the negligence of the party. So I don't think that the actual testimony is necessary toward the analysis. I would agree that it's not preserved, that it's not, that from that one particular aspect, that particular ruling by the court that was not appropriate for us to challenge. When I say that particular, the overall, we do challenge the overall prohibition by the court from allowing evidence of the other party's negligence, but as to consideration of the bill of review, that's not appropriate except the ruling during the trial that we know what the bill of review was going to address. The substance of the bill of review, I don't think matters to the determination. But in talking about that, I'm concerned that it gets away from the primary point, and that primary point is on the instructions, and were the instructions sufficient to, with the charge, without the instructions on instruction on simple negligence, was that sufficient to provide the guidelines for the jury so as to pass constitutional muster? And it was not. Because in order to pass constitutional muster, in order to provide for the due process rights of Universal Services or any other employer, the jury has to be given adequate guidelines. And that's really our primary point, that they were not given adequate guidelines to determine that this was not simple negligence, this was gross negligence. In this court's recent cases, very prominent cases, of course, of Moriel and of Walmart, it is remarkable the number of times, the number of references that the court makes to the distinction between simple negligence and gross negligence. It is very clear that this court is concerned that punitive damages not be awarded in a situation where only simple negligence is proved. And so what we are asking is that the court incorporate into the jury charge, into the procedures, into the process, this concern over the distinction between the two types of negligence and ensure that the jury is given adequate guidelines.
Hypothetically, if this were a rear-end collision case and the defendant stipulated to its liability for ordinary negligence, but there was still a punitive damage claim, is it your contention that the defendant, in spite of the stipulation of ordinary negligence and liability on that basis, would still be entitled to a similar instruction to the one you are requesting here, because without that instruction there would be no way to compare or put in context the claim for punitive damages? Would it be the same argument?
I think it would be the same argument, because it would be necessary to put it into a context. And just as in your hypothetical, it wouldn't be proper to ask the question. It would be proper, and I think it would be required to put in the instruction. Again, so the jury it understands what it's doing and the context in which he's doing it, or in which it's doing it. I think one way to help clarify the issues is to look at the facts in the case, and I don't want to belabor those other than just to remind the court what happened here. Mr. Ung was tragically killed whenever he was working on the side of the road cleaning debris from I-10 in Houston. And a truck with a trailer attached to it with a mismatched ball attached to the socket and secured only by a coat hanger hit a pothole, bounced loose, and struck Mr. Ung. Well, what happened after that? The driver of the truck, who was drunk and driving on a suspended license, he disappeared. The owner of the truck, he wasn't sued. The state of Texas, which was charged with maintaining the roadway, settled. The manufacturer of the hitch and the ball settled. And Universal Services was found guilty of $2.5 million in punitive damages. In the context of what happens, it seems clear under those circumstances that it did make a difference. That just as a practical matter, in looking at those circumstances, the fact that the jury wasn't instructed on what simple negligence was made a difference in the verdict based on that evidence that was before it. It almost seems illogical under those kinds of circumstances that it would find gross negligence under those circumstances against Universal Services. There is one final point that I would be remiss in not making, I think. I know that the court did not grant the petition based on our no evidence point, but just in addressing the ultimate relief granted by the court, if I may urge the court to render rather than reverse and remand, that is based on the test, as Chief Justice Phillips was referring to earlier, of course, the entire one of care and conscious indifference test, that in this case, just as a reminder, that there was not an entire one of care. There were numerous safety measures employed by Universal Services, but I think perhaps even more compelling is the second aspect of the test, the conscious indifference test. In this case, Lyle Stranlin, who is the name of the foreman who was there, who is the foreman for Universal Services, he was standing a mere 10 feet from Mr. And as the amicus said, if he was consciously indifferent, it would mean that he was not only homicidal, he was suicidal. So I submit to the court that there is not enough evidence, there is no evidence to show gross negligence, and I ask the court to reverse and remand the case.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. James B. Lewis will present the argument for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, justices. I'm Jim Lewis, representing the Ung family, respondents in this case. Bun Meng Ung, father of the Ungs, was killed due to the gross negligence of Universal, his employer, in failing to maintain a safe work environment and in placing him in the path of a known danger. The Ungs proved that Universal was aware of both the general risk of working along the side of the road and the specific risk involved in that place, right where the pothole was, because they'd seen a very similar accident occur about 8 months earlier. The Ungs brought substantial evidence proving that Universal disregarded the extreme risk and failed to properly place buffer trucks, failed to put up concrete barriers, failed to close off another lane of traffic, and failed to use flaggers on the scene.
How do you respond to the last statement made by Mr. Barato about supervisor being 10 feet away, and that shows a lack of want of care. It's not show lack of want of care, otherwise you'd be suicidal, have suicidal tendencies.
Your Honor, that was Mr. Stranlin, who'd actually seen the incident earlier, and Mr. Stranlin, if you read exactly the page where they cite in their brief, he was standing 10 feet away, he claimed, but he was standing behind barriers. And that's in the record, I believe, on page 1258. I'm not certain of the page. It's volume 11.
Does it make any difference the way this accident happened? That is, it hit a pothole and the trailer became disengaged. In other words, I'm wondering, in terms of the conscious indifference element of the gross negligence standard, whether any sort of Paul's graph-like chain of events would tend to prove conscious indifference in your view, or whether it's just the general nature of the danger, that is, a car may have veered off the road and run into them, that makes this gross negligence?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that the type of accident necessarily, the specific detail of the accident specifically makes a difference in the case, because it's always dangerous working along the side of the road, and you've got to put up the barriers, you've got to do certain precautions that are in the manual, and they admitted they didn't do that. But in this case, Mr. Jasper and Mr. Stranlin admitted that they were aware of the very danger which occurred. Mr. Stranlin had seen another trailer come loose just 8 months earlier, and luckily that trailer, which in the same spot, that trailer which came back, missed the workers alongside of the road. So he was aware of that specific danger. I'm not going to discuss the individual facts of the case much anymore, because there are only 2 points which have been granted in this case. And so I will address Universal's points 1 and 2. and that is first the trial court's refusal of the definition of negligence and ordinary care in this workers' compensation gross negligence death case, and second, the alleged exclusion of evidence pertaining to the negligence of other entities who were not parties to the suit at the time of trial. In reality, there was no exclusion of evidence at all. The UMS filed a supplemental response brief with appendices attached after writ was granted on these points, concentrating on the record, because Universal is making two distinct points here. First, they want you to change the law by overturning Wright, by overturning Joseph, and by overturning Accord and Roper. And second, Universal is requesting a reversal of this case. And these are two separate and distinct points, because the record does not and cannot support a reversal of the jury verdict and judgment of the trial court, regardless of whether this court changes the law. If this court so chooses, it can overrule Wright and it can overrule Joseph, but should still affirm this case because Universal waived its due process and equal protection complaints regarding the submission of this case to the jury. Universal did not request an issue regarding actual damages or object to its omission.
I don't understand why giving an ordinary negligence instruction would require overruling Wright, Cord, or Roper, or any of the cases that you mentioned.
Well, because those cases, the Wright case, said that you don't need an actual damages submission, and the Joseph case said that you don't need a negligence submission in a workers' compensation gross negligence case.
They're not asking for that. They're asking for instructions.
Yes, Your Honor, but the Roper case and the Accord case say any extraneous instructions, that is, instructions or definitions which don't pertain to issues which are asked of the jury, are reversible error because they tend to confuse the jury. The jury is going to be sitting here looking at a definition of negligence, and then they won't have any question asking about the negligence of any party. In that instance, they're going to wonder, what is this? And they're going to assume that the court is instructing them that this is a gross negligence case. We're giving you this definition of negligence, even though there's no question about negligence. And so the jury can only assume that the trial court is instructing them that this is only negligence and not gross negligence, because why else would it be in the charge?
Are you suggesting then if the court does mandate that instruction, that they also we ought to give the jury submit the issue of negligence also?
Well, that's the only way the instruction would be relevant, is if there was a question. I am not suggesting that this court require that it be submitted, because the employer can't possibly recover for ordinary negligence and actual damages. I agree with the right decision, but whether or not this court chooses to change the law in that regard, chooses to overrule either Joseph or Wright, is irrelevant to this case, because in this case they didn't request any issue regarding ordinary negligence or actual damages, nor did they object to the definition of gross negligence. And Ms. Liberato is telling you that you need these various guidelines, certain guidelines to guide the jury in what gross negligence and punitive damages are, but they never requested any guidelines. They never requested the Alamo versus Krauss factors, and they never objected to the omission of any such factors. In fact, they didn't object to any definition or instruction that was in the charge. They merely submitted the definitions of negligence and ordinary care, and the context in which they did that was because they submitted the negligence of the non-parties as well. They submitted a question about the negligence of the non-parties, but they did not bring that in a point of error. They are not complaining to this court that the issue of the negligence of the non-parties should be put in the charge at this point. Now,
why wouldn't ordinary negligence instruction make it clear?
Well, first of all, they didn't request any link or connection between the ordinary negligence instruction and the gross negligence instruction. It was just the ordinary instruction, negligence instruction standing alone.
Well, you might sort of pick up on it as you were reading through that ordinary negligence and then gross negligence by contrast. It looks like almost the obvious what the link is.
It may well be obvious, but counsel made it obvious in the closing argument, because the objection that she claims was sustained was only an objection as to the negligence of Hammerblow being outside the record because they never offered any evidence of the negligence of Hammerblow. The only thing that they are complaining about regarding the exclusion of evidence pertains to the court's pretrial rulings in the motions in limine. And I've attached every single page they cited in their brief as an exclusion of evidence as an appendix to the supplemental brief, which I filed several weeks ago. There was no exclusion of evidence, and they were allowed to freely talk about their own interpretation of the definition of gross negligence. And he had a pretty good interpretation of it. He said this means that we know of the danger and we just don't care. So the jury was well aware of the standard, and they were apprised of that standard, and they determined that Universal did know of the danger and Universal did not care. Now the standard of review here is abuse of discretion, and I would
somewhat... Let me ask you a question. It's easy to conceive when someone's operating a piece of machinery that they're operating it in just such a gross manner as to indicate that they don't care. It's harder for me to conceive when they are virtually stationary. They just place barriers and they just put someone out there on the side of a bridge in an inherently dangerous area like a bridge and cars zooming past, and one of those cars falls apart in the middle of the episode and strikes one of the people on the bridge. It strikes me that the inherent difficulty here is that it's that you're arguing that their inaction is so obviously lacking in care, which is not much different than negligence. It's sort of a disregard of circumstances when it's foreseeable that there could be a bad accident. In that circumstance, isn't there some significance to when you tell a jury that this is a high degree of negligence to have to get them, give them some sort of the relative degrees of negligence? Here's a level of negligence, and therefore here's a high degree of negligence, and the jury has to consider the high degree before they can answer this question. Doesn't it make sense under those circumstances where it's not so obvious that this action is a high degree that the jury be provided some help in evaluating the relative nature of these degrees?
Well, Your Honor, even the instruction which they submitted, just an ordinary negligence definition, would not provide them with that guidance because they made no connection or link between ordinary negligence and gross negligence. They just provided the definition of negligence, and the context in which they did that was along with the question of the ordinary negligence regarding the other entities. They never submitted an issue regarding the ordinary negligence of Universal. If this court so chooses to reverse the Otis versus Joseph case or overrule it and require in a workers' compensation case them to prove negligence as a stepping stone and then gross negligence, this court can do that and still affirm this case and still should affirm this case because they did not submit an issue inquiring regarding the negligence of Universal. They only submitted an issue inquiring regarding the negligence of non-parties, and they're not complaining about the refusal of that issue. So here, what they're suggesting wouldn't give them the guidance that you are suggesting. They may need more guidance, but that has to do with the definition of gross negligence. This is just a veiled allegation that the definition of gross negligence is inadequate. And whether it is or not is irrelevant to the determination of this case because they never objected to the definition of gross negligence. They had plenty of opportunity to do so, but they did not object to the definition and they did not submit any instructions or any alternative definition of gross negligence.
If their only complaint ever was and ever meant to be that you ought to get the ordinary negligence instruction along with the gross negligence instruction, how would they preserve that?
If that's their only complaint, then certainly at a bare minimum, I would have thought they would have requested some link or connection between the ordinary negligence definition and the gross negligence instruction. But beyond that,
I believe that it would still be reversible under Accord or Roper to just have that definition, because there is no issue inquiring as to the negligence of any party. If they wanted to incorporate something about negligence, ordinary negligence, as part of the definition of gross negligence, then they should have submitted an alternative definition of gross negligence doing just that. But they did not submit an alternative definition, nor did they object to anything about the wording of the gross negligence submission or object to its submission at all.
Isn't inherent in your argument the notion that gross negligence is a separate thing from negligence with a high degree of care or a high degree of want of care? You seem to be arguing that if you give a definition of what negligence is, then you must submit an issue of negligence, as opposed to gross negligence, which is some sort of different animal. If this court determines that you've got to define negligence first before you can define what is gross about that negligence, then your argument would fall, wouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, gross negligence is an entirely separate standard with an entirely different definition.
And so you can be gross negligent without at least at first meeting the threshold of being negligent in the first instance.
Certainly it goes beyond that. No, I mean, you must be negligent in order to be grossly negligent. But they didn't request an instruction stating to the jury that you must be negligent before you are grossly negligent, and here's the definition of negligence. And even if they had, that would merely be a change in the definition of gross negligence, to which they never objected. Perhaps, and in fact, the amicus offered some guidance in this regard. They suggested alternative instructions of gross negligence incorporating the definition of negligence. That was not requested here, and no objection was made to the definition of gross negligence. They submitted the definition of negligence in a vacuum, just standing alone, and the context of that dealt with the question regarding the negligence of other entities, and they're not complaining about that refusal.
Mr. Lewis, let me ask you to return for a moment with me to the facts of this case and the ungranted point regarding conscious indifference. You mentioned that Strandlin testified that a year earlier he'd seen an accident occur in a similar manner with a disengaged trailer. And my question is there any other evidence that you can point to that tends to prove a subjective awareness on the part of the defendant that they were exposing the decedent to an extreme risk of harm? Or is that it?
No, that is not it, Your Honor. In fact, Mr. Jasper testified that if he'd have known of the hole in the area, that he never would have allowed them to work in the area near the pothole because that presented an ultra-hazardous situation.
But he didn't even know of the pothole?
He did not know of that, but Mr. Strandlin did know of the pothole, and Mr. Strandlin admitted that he did know of the danger. But he figured they were just going to be in the area for about 30 minutes, so it didn't justify the time and expense of erecting barriers and complying with what the minimum compliance was with the manual, and erecting barriers and guards and properly placing buffer trucks. And he didn't do that even though he had subject awareness of the actual danger involved.
And let me ask you, how can you distinguish that awareness or that notice that Mr. Strandlin had of the dangerousness of the situation with the kind of notice that would be relevant certainly to proving a negligence, an ordinary negligence claim, that is awareness of some risk, to conscious indifference under the gross negligence standard? Is this somehow different in kind or from ordinary notice in a negligence case?
Well, it's different in the respect that he was aware of the general danger of being on the road without erecting the buffer barriers and complying with the manual. All of them were aware of that. And he was aware of this specific type of incident, this specific type of accident which actually occurred. Now, I don't believe the latter is required for even a gross negligence finding. just being aware of the dangers of not erecting the barriers, not properly placing the buffer trucks when they are in danger from the moment they step on the road until the time that they leave, by their own admission. And so if you don't take the precautions that are set out as a minimum in the manual, certainly that is gross negligence. And they are aware of the general danger and the specific danger involved.
Hypothetically, if there had been a collision on the roadway nearby and a flying piece of debris from an accident, say 100 yards away, had hit the decedent in this case and killed him, would that have been gross negligence?
Depending on the circumstances of whether they had properly placed buffer trucks or barriers that could possibly have prevented the accident, yes, that could be gross negligence. In this case, there was testimony that if the buffer trucks alone had been properly placed, it would have prevented the accident. So this was clearly a proximate cause of the accident, the failure to erect the concrete barriers and the failure to properly place the buffer trucks. Now, the only other point of error which is granted is really a moot point. They claim that there's exclusion of evidence. I've attached the evidence that they offered and admitted to my supplemental brief, and that shows that not only was negligence of these other entities admitted, but an opinion regarding the gross negligence of Marburger and Kay, the owners of the pickup and the driver of the pickup, was allowed into evidence, and any objections were overruled by Judge Garcia. And they referenced all of that evidence in their closing argument. And it's clear that they simply did not understand the effect of the judge's rulings on the motion in limine, that it was merely requiring them to approach the bench. You noted the bill of exceptions, which I also attached at the end of the brief.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
We ask that you affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Ms. Liberato, how do you respond to Mr. Lewis' statement that what you're really saying is that the definition of gross negligence is not sufficient in this context? What you really are saying that when you're defining gross negligence, you need to, within that, set up the negligence definition.
Well, it's a risk of sounding trite. I think there's more than one way to skin a cat. I think that that would be one way of doing it, that there could be a definition of gross negligence that would incorporate simple negligence, and that would be appropriate, that would cure the harm, cure the ill. But I don't think just because that's correct, that means that the way we did it was incorrect, because the definition that we submitted was the one out of the pattern jury charge. And frankly, the practical matter, it was the one that if we were going to get one, that was going to be the one we were the most likely to get because it did come out of the pattern jury charge. So I could certainly understand that the court, as a policymaking court, could say that there's a better way of doing it than the way we did it. There's a different definition that should be used. There's one that would be even more clear to the jury. But that would not mean and does not mean that our approach was not also proper and properly preserved, because we did in fact submit to the jury a definition, the pattern jury charge definition of simple negligence. We are not asking the court to overrule anything, certainly not Wright versus Gifford Hill. What we are asking the court to do is to bring into line with Morial and with Walmart the charge, the concern, into the charge, the concerns about the distinction between simple negligence and gross negligence. And so I know I'm being repetitious, but I want to be very clear on this matter. There may be many ways to do it. One way is the way we did it, and we believe not only was that proper, but certainly it was preserved because we submitted it to the court and she ruled on it and denied it. The other issue I think that is important is the review of the evidence, and again I think that the respondent also highlights, and some of the questions the court highlights, the problem with this case. Looking at the evidence, there is evidence of, and certainly it would be hard to reverse on if there was a finding of simple negligence, that there is evidence of some carelessness. But the evidence simply does not reach the standard of gross negligence.
Why doesn't Mr. Strandlin's testimony, why isn't that some evidence of conscious indifference?
Well, I think that I don't think it may. I don't think it shows conscious indifference. I think what it shows is error in judgment. It sure shows some carelessness. I think the terminology that this court used in another case in determining what's simple versus gross negligence, I think that's what it shows. But I do not think that it shows meets that requisite level of conscious indifference.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take another brief recess.
The audience will please rise.